Life is a highway, and on it there will be many chicken sandwiches. But there's only one McCrispy. So go ahead and hit the turn signal if you know about this juicy gem of a detour.
Welcome to Rex Factor.
This week, Sophia Dorothea of Zella.
With your hosts, Graham Duke and Ali Hood.
Hello.
Hello. This is going to be a long one, I think, isn't it? genuinely had to write that down.
Hello and welcome to Rex Factor, reviewing all the Queen and Prince consorts of England, from Elswith to Prince Philip. Follow us on Twitter, X, and Instagram at Rex Factor Pod. Email rexfactorpodcast@hotmail.com and sign up for bonus content at patreon.com/rexfactor. Now, this week we are reviewing Sophia Dorothea of Zella, the wife to the first Hanoverian monarch, George I, but not actually the consort.
What?
All will be explained over the course of the episode, but essentially I decided it was an interesting and relevant story to cover, even though she's, as we see, technically not a consort. So we'll find out who she was, who she wasn't, and what's going on.
Biography!
Sophia Dorothea was born on the 15th of September 1666, just a week or so after the Great Fire of London.
That's interesting, because I feel like we're very much modern now that you're saying about George I. Yet, yeah, 1666 belongs still to Elizabeth to me. Even though it's not.
Well, yeah, 63 years after Elizabeth died. But
any century that's touched by her, yes, is hers. It's close.
And she's born in the Duchy of Zella, which is in Lower Saxony, so northern Germany. And the daughter of George William, Duke of Brunswick-Lüneburg, and Eleanor Desmier d'Olbruys.
Oh, I'm in trouble, Graham.
Well, it's a George and an Eleanor.
Oh, fine.
In the late 17th century, Germany is not yet actually a country. So instead, we've got a collection of duchies, principalities and mini-states, all within the Holy Roman Empire.
Well, that's still dragging on, is it?
It is. Now, by 1701, which is within the period of this episode, Prussia will become dominant and a proper country that is the forerunner to Germany. But at this point, duchies, they're all very much in flux, regularly change ownership in a way that, as you'll see, does actually quite significantly impact Sophia's story. Sophia Dorothea's father was the second of four sons, quite a carefree bachelor who actually wriggles his way out of a betrothal to Sophia of the Palatinate, who's a granddaughter of James I. However, when his older brother dies, having expanded the sort of family territories to include the Duchy of Zella, there's suddenly a lot of responsibility on George William's shoulders, Sophia's father. So he chooses to cede some of his territories to his two younger brothers, particularly the youngest one, Ernest, who had done him quite a big favour by marrying Sophia of the Palatinate in his place.
What's just happened there?
Sophia Dorothea's father, George William.
Yeah.
Carefree bachelor, living the life of Riley. Older brother dies, suddenly everything falls to him. So he's like, tell you what, I'm going to keep some of this for funsies, but younger brothers, you guys take on some of the other bits and bobs and do the work. But when he was previously betrothed to this Sophia of the Palatinate, to avoid a diplomatic incident in just dumping her, his younger brother Ernest just takes his place and marries her instead.
Does him a favour.
Yeah. So we've got George William, who is chilled out, wants to be a bachelor. Brother number three only has daughters. So the plan is that actually everything will go to brother number four, the youngest one, Ernest.
Right. God, he struck out, didn't he?
He did, yeah.
I mean, I don't know what that phrase means and whether it's appropriate, but you know what I mean. Mm. Wow.
It might actually mean the opposite. I think isn't struck out when you don't get luck. He struck gold. Yeah.
Struck gold, yeah. Mm. It's just sort of vaguely 80s American slang. God, he really booed and yard at that, didn't he?
George William's fine with this. They've decided, yeah, everything goes to Ernest. He's the ambitious one. He's the one that really wants to work for this. So in support of this, George William actually pledges to remain unmarried. So there'll be no danger of any squabbles over inheritance. Right. It's all going to Ernest.
You're doing me such a good favour. Promise to you, not even. Yeah.
Until 1665, when the grand plan comes under threat because George William does something decidedly unexpected. he falls in love.
Oh, I hadn't thought about that.
Yeah, well, exactly, neither had he. And the focus of his ardour is Eleanor Desmier d'Olbreuse, who is, I don't know why I'm saying d'Olbreuse as if she's Scottish. She's a beautiful daughter of a Huguenot family of lower nobility, and they're exiled from the court of Louis XIV. They end up at the court of Cassel, which is where he catches sight of her. And Eleanor follows the Anne Boleyn playbook, so she refuses to surrender her honour in becoming his mistress, which naturally, like Henry VIII, inflames his passions to such a height, the only solution is to marry her.
Mm. It's a well-worn, it's a good tactic, isn't it?
And sort of similar to Henry VIII, there is a problem there in this case because he promised brother Ernest that he was not going to get married. Yeah, and here he is getting married.
Yeah.
Thankfully, though, a compromise is found because it's just a morganatic marriage. So that means they are legitimately married within the eyes of the church, but Eleanor doesn't have any rights in terms of succession to lands and titles, nor do any of his children.
God, what a cynical sort of... I don't know what I find more cynical, the idea that actually marriage is a totally a financial thing, or splitting it apart and being able to do the two separately.
Yeah. I mean, it's nice in a way, isn't it? He's saying, look, I don't want to cause any trouble. I just genuinely want to marry this woman.
Yeah, I think I'm thinking about it too much. I think that's it, isn't it? It's quite a nice thing of being able to say that without getting anyone into trouble because he'd made a deal. Yeah, useful. I'll take that.
And they seem to have been very happily married, living something of a sort of bourgeoisie life. Sophia Dorothea is born the next year. Eleanor has no official title or status because of the morganatic marriage, other than being given the honorary title Lady of Harburg. So this sort of means that she's a little bit more free to live without having to worry about some of the expectations of society. So she personally raises Sophia, who seems to have been adored and indulged by both parents. So, Sophia Dorothea grows into a beautiful young woman. She's got dark brown, almost black hair, very large eyes. She's quite cultured and sophisticated. She's got French tastes and a passion for fashion.
I mean, that's definitely a euphemism, isn't it? It's like being tired and emotional when you get sacked. You're drunk, isn't it?
I mean, you might get tired and emotional when you get sacked. In both senses.
Yeah. I mean, but you would be tired and emotional then.
Although not an heir to her father's title, she does come with a substantial dowry because her father's very rich. So she's still quite an attractive marriage prospect, even though she's not technically going to inherit Zella.
Oh, right. Oh, okay. So it's still... Oh, so you still get something for it. That's quite annoying, actually, as far as my cynical arguments go.
Well, I mean, he's just a rich man. Her father.
Yeah, he can carry the way.
So, Sophia Dorothea is betrothed in 1675, only for her intended to die in battle the following year.
Oh, they're not still doing that nonsense, are they?
Oh, there's lots of battles, yeah, in this part of the world, in Europe.
Oh, okay, yeah, that's that whole fractured thing we were talking about.
So we've got Germany, German states, the Scandinavia, Louis XIV, there's almost constant warfare. So she loses that prospective husband, and they struggle a bit. So there's still people who are interested, but they're not quite managing to seal the deal, and perhaps her semi-legitimate status is kind of a stumbling block. You're not fully sure what you're getting, and is it worth
it's
it or
not? Clear.
However, her parents are able to mitigate this obstacle. Her father establishes, as you said, a huge dowry for her, and he keeps putting more money into it. And her mother seems to be very good at about PR and working the room. So she establishes close links to the Holy Roman Emperor and persuades George William to offer substantial military support to the Emperor in the various wars that are going on. So in return, the Holy Roman Emperor gives his assent when George William decides to declare the marriage fully lawful. So it's no longer just a morganatic. Well, as in, it's no longer just a morganatic marriage. It's a full-on, she's just my normal, legally wedded wife with no caveat or asterisks.
So it's combining those two bits now.
So Sophia Dorothea is now his heir, and she becomes the Princess of Brunswick-Lundberg-Zella.
Okay. All right, now we've started.
Good for her, less so for Brother Ernest in Hanover. Now, relations between Zella and Hanover have been increasingly tense in recent years. So, Sophia of the Palatinate, so that's now Ernest's wife, but the one that was spurned by George William. Bit of tension there, as you can imagine. She snobbishly describes Eleanor as a little clot of dirt.
Oh, it's going one way, isn't it now? There was a chance to be grown up and we could manage this. Oh, dear.
But now the personal tensions become political because Sophia Dorothea's future husband will almost certainly want to lay claim to George William's titles now that it's a properly legit marriage between her parents. Mm. And that will break up the grand inheritance which had been promised to Ernest in Hanover. So all the promises, all the grand lay plans are suddenly just gradually starting to break apart. Now, Ernest is a highly ambitious chap, and he's working to have Hanover elevated to elector status in the empire, which, again, won't go into too much, but basically it's one of the sort of the top people in this huge realm of different mini-states. The elector ones are the really important ones that pick the empire, so he wants Hanover to really be right at the top table, and losing all this territory, or rather not gaining it as expected, will undermine a lot of his hard work. Thankfully, though, Ernest is a pragmatic man, so the solution is very clear. Sophia Dorothea's husband is going to claim all of her lands, so the best thing to do is marry his son, George Louis, to Sophia Dorothea. And that ensures that all the money, all the titles, and all the land will stay very much in the family, given that they are, of course, first cousins.
Oh, God. Right.
Now, the fathers, or brothers, as they know, are very pleased with themselves. They've sorted everything out nicely. Good diplomatic work here. Marriage alliance. Mothers both have misgivings. Besides their own tensions, of course, it's also very clear to them that their children are going to be ill-matched. So Sophia Dorothea is 16 at this point, very outgoing. She enjoys playful conversation, cheerful company, extravagant entertainment, very cultured, as we said. In contrast, George Louis, who's 22, is extremely reserved. Quite a dour personality. His idea of a good time apparently being a quiet game of cards for low stakes after a heavy supper. While one observer noted he was ordinarily neither cheerful nor friendly, his words have to be squeezed out of him.
I think we'd get on. I like the sound of him. Like, no, I like people whose company it's comfortable to be silent in. And have a nice big slap up and game of cards, not for anything.
Off to bed.
Off to bed.
However, the enormous dowry on offer is enough to convince Sophia the Palatinate that they've got to take the deal, despite her misgivings. So she writes that Sophia Dorothea would find in my son the most pig-headed, stubborn boy who ever lived, who has round his brain such a thick crust that I defy any man or woman ever to discover what is in them. He does not care much for the match itself, but 100,000 thalers a year have tempted him as they would have tempted anybody else.
Oh, I like the cut of her jib.
Sophia Dorothea herself, however, is not quite so acquiescent. She already knows of her cousin's character and declares on hearing of the betrothal that she would have to be dragged to the altar. And when she saw her father carrying a painted miniature of George Louis, she snatched it from his hands, flung it against the wall, shouting, "I will not marry the pig snout!"
Oh, imagine that. Those tensions and that emotion, that'd be absolutely awful.
Of course, she did marry him in 1682. Yeah. And actually, things begin surprisingly well. She quickly charms her uncle, stroke father-in-law, Ernest. And the birth of a son the following year very much cements her status in Hanover. Straight away, son and heir born.
Okay, so could they actually divorce at this point?
Well, you never really want to, because then there's question marks over the legitimacy of the children, etc. But, you know, done a job, got the son. She enjoys a lot of the grand celebrations that Ernest is regularly laying out at sort of palaces in Hanover, such as Herrenhausen, because he wants to demonstrate Hanover's magnificence as part of his campaign to get the elector status. And Sophia the Palatinate, despite her misgivings about her daughter-in-law, does seem to try to help her settle in at court.
Oh, that's nice. So she's sort of taking her enemy's daughter under her wing and seeing the good.
Yeah. Her husband, George Louis, is often away on military campaigns, but given his personality, it's probably not actually a bad thing that he's not often there. In 1686, Ernest invites her to join the rest of the family when they go on an extended holiday to Italy, which she seems to have greatly enjoyed. They were there for a carnival. She has good time. George Louis joins them, and the following year, a second child, a daughter, is born.
Oh, this is looking up, isn't it?
So we're sort of, in some ways, we're ticking a lot of boxes of things going well, but unfortunately, these are rare highlights. Sofia Dorotea is used to a very relaxed environment in Celle, and she's struggling to adapt to life in Hanover, which is ruled by pomp and protocol modelled on Louis XIV's court at Versailles.
Mm, as always.
She just largely ignores it and does her own thing, with one courtier describing her as une beauté tyrannique.
Tyrannical beauty?
Hmm.
Why is she tyrannical?
I guess, you know, she's sort of this sort of beautiful figure that just does whatever she wants and isn't...
Can't be tamed. Good.
And what's more, she and George, as predicted, hate each other.
Oh, no.
He frequently upbraids her for failing to observe Hanoverian etiquette, resulting in frequent loud and bitter arguments. He then humiliates her by taking a full-time mistress, Melusine von der Schulenburg, which in itself is not unusual, but he breaks convention by flaunting his mistress publicly, as well as very clearly having no respect for Sofia Dorotea as his wife. Mm. She breaks convention as well by showing how furious she is about this. So during one argument, she follows him into his study to continue an argument that they were having, and he becomes so enraged that he throws her to the ground and tries to throttle her until some attendants have to come and intervene.
Oh, lordy.
Well, at this point, his mother does step in. She urges George to be more discreet with his affair, more publicly respectful towards Sofia Dorotea, i.e. put on a show for the cameras. And she also speaks to Sofia Dorotea in turn, telling her, from personal experience, mistresses are a fact of life. You should just look the other way, make the best of it.
Yeah, I mean, as much as that, those morals are different to today, they are both being a bit childish. Like, being an adult is restraining yourself in various ways from being the raw monkey that lies beneath. And they don't seem to be doing that.
Well, Sofia Dorotea does then look the other way. But not quite in the manner that was advised, because the other way that she looked was to embark on an affair of her own.
Oh, right. Okay.
With the Swedish aristocrat Philip von Konigsmark. He's handsome, witty, charismatic, essentially everything her husband isn't.
Played by... what's it called? I want to say Max Boneyman, but that's not right.
He's Max Boneyman.
Something like that. He's married to Alicia Vikander. She's a Swedish actress. This is where my mind went. Michael Fassbender. That's it.
Max Boneyman.
I was pretty close. I mean, it's in the right. If they were friends, you wouldn't bat an eyelid.
Catherine Curzon, historian, described him as the quintessential roguish hero, a soldier and adventurer with looks and charm to spare. An equal mixture of Mars and Adonis, according to his adoring sister.
Perfect. I mean, if that isn't Max Boneyman, I have no idea. Wow, okay, so what a prize.
So they'd actually known each other as children, but their relationship only really starts after 1689 when Philip comes to Hanover to serve in the army.
Mm.
So by this point, Sofia Dorotea's marriage definitely broken down. She's a very miserable and isolated figure. Court. It's slow to begin, though. She keeps him at arm's length initially, though she does give him permission to write to her when he was sent to the front in 1690. But Philip's rather anguished letters to her suggest he couldn't cope when she wasn't writing with the frequency he seemed to require, and she still remains cautious when he comes back to Hanover. It's only in 1692, after a battle at Namur, when her feelings are fully awoken, when she spends several days waiting to hear if he has survived. They're very heavy casualties and she doesn't hear any news about him for some time. So she wrote to him, not knowing whether he was actually alive or not, saying, "I hate King William, i.e. the third, who is the cause of it all. He breaks my heart by thus risking all I have in the world."
Ooh. Well, it's nice that they're feeling emotions again, but that must be awful. I mean, like any war.
Well, her mood is transformed when she hears that he is unharmed, and it's after this, it seems, that their affair began. So it's a sensual, emotional, and not especially discreet love affair.
Mm.
So their letters reveal them both to be very sensitive, highly strung characters, lots of florid letters, declarations of undying love, regular outbursts of jealousy over nothing in particular.
Mm.
And they also conducted their affair with what one historian has deemed the most extraordinary abandon. So they entrust letters to servants. Sophia Dorothea leaves notes in his hat and gloves, which are obviously just, you know, left in a quite public area and hallway, so anyone could happen upon them. But nevertheless, rumours do very, very quickly spread everywhere about it. So many people try in vain to urge caution on them, but always falls on deaf ears. One attempt by Sophia Dorothea's mother-in-law, Sophia the Palatinate, to gauge her feelings towards Philip, sees Sophia Dorothea get completely the wrong end of the stick. She praises you so highly that were she younger, I should be jealous. I really think she's fond of you.
Ah. Ah. How old is she at this point?
Ooh, she's sort of early to mid-20s.
Okay.
Mid-20s. So instead they have to make sort of subtle efforts to force them apart. So Philip sent off to fight the Danes. As they part of the army, just not just to one man.
Well, it is Max Ponyman. He can do anything. Let's send in Max Ponyman.
While Sophia Dorothea is just sent on trips to visit George's relatives with sort of ladies to keep an eye on her.
Lord, they're trying to kill her too.
However, opportunities are always to be found. Ernest finally achieves his dream of having Hanover granted elector status. Uh-huh. So he takes the whole family to Berlin to mark the occasion. But Sophia Dorothea feigns illness, meaning she has to stay behind where she can frolic with Philip.
Oh, nice. Hmm. Well, the cat's away at European Union summit.
Indeed, yes. So they start making plans to elope. So Sophia Dorothea starts having a look at things, but on inspecting her marriage contract, she's horrified to discover that she actually has no financial provision in her own name.
Oh dear.
He, George, is absolutely master of everything, for there is nothing I can dispose of without his consent. Even the clause about my dower is so badly worded that they can easily cheat me and take it away. This, of course, is because the whole point of the marriage is to make sure that everything goes to her husband, George, to keep all the territories together. She asked her father for an independent income, but he isn't able to comply because there's a war against Denmark, meaning he's both short of cash and, with the troops not a million miles away, also does really need the support of Hanover in case he gets invaded. And what's more, Philip is living beyond his means. He's accrued considerable gambling debts, and rumours of the affair are prohibiting his advancement in the Hanoverian army.
Oh, gosh. Stuck.
However, when an old friend inherits the Duchy of Saxony, Philip is now made a major general in that army, and suddenly prospects are greatly improved.
Oh, he just goes to a different territory where he's got a mate?
Yeah.
And takes vision? Oh, right, okay. This sort of fractious nature of these territories does present a lot of opportunities to the right people.
Yeah.
But unfortunately, they're a very limited pool of people.
Indeed. So Philip proceeds to get roaringly drunk and regales the Saxony court with insults about the Hanoverian court. So how the elector's mistress, Clara von Platen, uses milk baths and excessive makeup to hide her fading beauty, while Prince George is a fool for taking so drab a mistress when he has such a beautiful wife.
Oh.
Naturally, news of this comes back to Hanover, leading George to storm into Sophia Dorothea's rooms, demanding an explanation. She, of course, doubles down, tells him that he and his father were laughing stocks for being in the pockets of their mistresses. And once again, George gets violent, throttles Sophia Dorothea almost unconscious until her lady drags him off.
Who is this dude?
This is future George the First.
Oh. Right.
Now, George is set to leave court to visit his sister in Berlin, and he tells Sophia Dorothea that before he leaves, "This constraint is too much. On my return, I shall write to your father and demand a separation."
First sensible thing he's done all episode.
Yeah, so on one level, that's good news, really. Sophia Dorothea wants out of the marriage, of course. So does George. Good. Probably the best thing that can happen.
Yeah.
However, after twice being physically abused by him, she understandably doesn't really want to wait around for his return and to trust that he will settle things a way that's good for her. So instead, she slips away in the middle of the night, rides to her parents at Zella, and begs for their support. Her mother is horrified and agrees, but her father, very much mindful of the diplomatic situation, says no.
Oh,
And the only reason she doesn't go straight back to Hanover is because basically on advice of the court doctor that says she's exhausted and needs to rest.
Why don't she go to Max Bonyman?
Oh, he's off fighting the Danes again.
Oh, see, right. That is one of the drawbacks.
You know what you're getting when you sign up to life with Max Bonyman.
It's that kind of life, babe. And off he goes. Oh, for goodness sake.
So after a few months, she is then sent back to Hanover, and she's going to go back to Ernest and Sophia at Herrenhausen, so there'll be a sort of public performance of Unity, lest anyone think her absence was because of any internal conflict. But instead, she defies the protocol and orders her coach to take her instead to the palace at Leinschloss, where she feigns illness and waits for Philip to come.
I mean, it's a trick that's worked before, isn't it?
Now, unfortunately, their elopement plans are widely suspected. As I said, they're not really subtle about anything, so news of everything gets around. Mm-hmm. Anyway, their plans are widely suspected, not least by one of the women that Philip had denigrated whilst drunk in Saxony, the mistress of Ernest, Clara von Platen. Now, she has long resented Sophia Dorothea, who'd sort of deliberately sought to outshine her in dress and appearance once she arrived in Hanover. And Clara also has had her own tryst with Philip, but is now particularly irked because he had refused to marry her daughter. So she's looking for an opportunity to bring them both down a peg or two. But because Ernest has remained very fond of Sophia Dorothea and resistant to all criticism of her, Clara hasn't got anywhere. But if she can prove that an elopement is planned, which, as I said, will be a PR disaster for Hanover, that will be enough. She'll be able to get him on board. So Clara sends Philip a letter purporting to be from Sophia Dorothea, asking him to come and visit. On arrival, it's a bit confusing when Sophia says, "I didn't write," and he's like, "Oh, this is weird." But nevertheless, obviously they chat, and he tells her, "I've got a carriage waiting, let's go, make a run for it, head off to Wolfenbüttel."
I'm with you all the way to the last word, Philip. Where are we going?
Wolfenbüttel.
Okay.
And she says yes, but she wants to wait a day so that she can say goodbye to the children.
Of course, she's got two children, yeah. Oh.
Now, of course, because Clara has sent that letter, she set it all up, her spies are in place, they're watching and listening to everything, so she is able to tell Ernest that there is a formal plan to elope in place, so Ernest agrees, Philip's going to have to be arrested. So Philip sneaks back into the palace, but finds the door leading to Sophia Dorothea's rooms locked.
Uh-oh.
And he then turns around to find himself surrounded by four of Clara's men.
Oh, man.
He's surrounded, so obviously he tries to fight his way out, but is overpowered.
He's Max Bonyman.
He's what? Max Bonyman, of course. This is too much fight, even for Max Bonyman.
That is outrageous. These guys must be, their own type of superhero.
So he's overpowered, but instead of being arrested, he is hacked to death.
What? Oh, this is totally two centuries ago stuff.
Some accounts of Clara then kicking Philip as he lay dying. But quickly she seems to have panicked, realising that she had somewhat exceeded her brief, given that Ernest had only said to arrest him.
This woman's a psychopath.
So she goes back and tells Ernest all about it. He's furious, but obviously, once again, PR, so orders all traces of the murder to be suppressed.
Yeah, I mean, this is absolute power stuff.
So there are varying accounts of what became of Philip's body, but the most accepted version is that he was put in a sack and weighted down with stones before being thrown into the river.
And this is George the First? His wife?
Yes.
Where's George the First in this?
He's in Berlin visiting his sister.
Yes.
The four assassins have their silence bought, so Ernest provides them with unexplained huge bonuses, something like 100 times their annual salaries.
Gosh.
But, as you're saying, struggling to place these events in a century. Mm. To quote, not for the first time, Blackadder, "These aren't the days of Alfred the Great. You can't lop someone's head off and blame it on the Vikings."
Yeah. Oh, man, they put it so well. That's exactly what I mean. What's going on? I know where these aren't democracies, but on the same hand, they're tempered powers now, right?
Mm. You know, and Philip is a well-respected soldier and diplomat. He'd served at numerous courts across Europe, including England. And obviously people want to know where he's gone, not least his friend and actual employer, the Elector of Saxony.
Well, everyone's waiting for the next movie.
Yes. So the Elector of Saxony sent an envoy to conduct an inquiry to find out what's happened to his major general.
Yeah.
Hanover denied all knowledge of his whereabouts and actually complained to the Holy Roman Emperor about Saxony's unfriendly acts and threatened to withdraw troops from the Grand Alliance against Louis XIV.
Oh, panic, gaslighting, Trumpian stuff. Yeah.
So in turn, William III of England becomes concerned at the impact this will all have, because this is essentially his Grand Alliance against Louis XIV.
Oh my God. So we've got... Okay, so at this point, we've got the Penguin about to investigate the death of Max Boneman, played by that fella. Right.
Well, in this case, the Penguin gives a very different order. He just wants the alliance back together, so he basically gets his envoy to speak to the Elector of Saxony and say, don't you think that maybe you're actually quite satisfied with the explanation from Hanover and we can all move on and forget about Max Boneyman?
Do and they take that advice?
And they take that advice. Max Boneyman is forgotten. The bigger question, though, is what to do with Sophia Dorothea. Now, for a while, she doesn't know what's happened, but she's placed under effective house arrest and barred from seeing her children. She rages against her imprisonment until her inquisitor, Count von Platen, i.e. Clara's husband, tells her of Philip's death and the discovery of the incriminating letters, and basically that she's in a whole heap of trouble. Sophia Dorothea collapses with grief, and Ernest places her on suicide watch before then sending her to Alden Castle in her father's territories while they try to come up with a solution.
Crikey. She could be disappeared as well.
Well, the problem is, one, obviously it's his niece, so his brother's daughter, but also they don't want the truth of the affair to emerge. They don't want the public embarrassment. And also, obviously, you can't claim to know nothing about what's happened to Philip von Königsmark, but also take action against Sophia for having an affair with him. Oh, yeah, we know nothing about why he's disappeared, but we do know that we're going to come down pretty hard on Sophia for having an affair with him. Coincidentally.
Yeah. Oh, true. So what they need, she's actually got all the power then here. They need her to go out in public and say, yeah, everything's fine.
Well, exactly. So that is what they offer. They say that despite everything, they will overlook the indiscretions if she returns to George and in public resumes her wifely duties.
Okay. Gosh, this is dark, isn't it?
It is. And the thing is that Sophia Dorothea is, understandably, absolutely determined to get out of the marriage, so unequivocally refuses the offer. We declare that we still adhere to our oft-repeated resolution never to cohabit matrimonially with our husband, and that we desire nothing so much as that separation of marriage requested by our husband may take place.
Yeah, what's the point in this? Well, she is cool.
So there was never actually a formal trial as such, but instead an ecclesiastical court heard a case for divorce on the grounds of Sophia Dorothea's incompatibility of temper added to some little failings of character, and principally her refusal to live with George, i.e. desertion rather than adultery.
So all her fault?
Yes, but nothing to do with the affair. They're not mentioning that at all. It's the fact that she's refusing to live with him. So desertion.
Does the throttling even come up?
No, it doesn't come up. The fact that he's been abusing her and obviously unfaithful to her is not a concern for the ecclesiastical court. As you said, she is eager to enter the marriage, so ultimately she does decide to admit her guilt, hoping to retire from the world and live with her mother at Zella, and basically just get out.
Yeah.
However, she had been deceived, so the marriage is dissolved on the 28th of December 1694, and George is given leave to remarry. But as the guilty party, Sophia Dorothea is not allowed to remarry.
Does she want to?
Well, she might want to. Obviously, their concern is that the whole point of the marriage is that the Sella inheritance isn't diverted away from Hanover, so can't have a remarrying. Right. Now, once the verdict has been reached, it's a case of damnatio memoriae, so Sophia Dorothea becomes a non-person. Her name is struck out of prayers, portraits are taken down and destroyed, her two children, aged 11 and 7, are put into George's care, and she is never allowed to see them again, nor is her name mentioned to them, and they are not allowed to speak of her again.
God, that's so vengeful.
And she herself is then sent back to Alden under strict confinement. So the castle is guarded 24 hours a day by 40 men-at-arms, of whom 5 to 10 would be on duty at any one time. All her household attendants are appointed by Ernest, swearing an oath to watch her every move, and anything suspect is to be reported to the governor. No visitors are permitted, and her only contact with her family are a series of paintings hung on her walls.
That is ghastly.
For the first few months, she's not even allowed to go outside, though this is relaxed from 1695, so she gets a half-hour walk and carriage rides under close guard.
And no one knows that this is even happening. It's not like a Twitter movement around Europe.
She's decided to retire to live in the country.
Mm. It does sound quite nice.
Even within the castle, certain areas are out of bounds. So on one occasion, a fire broke out, and as her only route of escape was to cross a forbidden gallery, she actually just stands terrified on the threshold, clutching a box of jewellery until someone comes along to authorise her to cross said gallery.
Oh. Well, that's so sad.
That said, she's not locked in a dungeon, so she's granted the title of the Duchess of Alden, as I said, to maintain the pretense that this is all voluntary, and does have a very generous income.
But what's the point of that? It's like a Greek tragedy, that she can have all the money in the world.
Yes.
But we'll just remove the... You're a total island, with the knowledge that you've got a family. Horrible.
After tireless appeals, her mother is eventually granted the right to visit her. And Sophia Dorothea did hope that her compliance would eventually see her be released. But when Ernest dies in 1698, and thus her husband George becomes the Elector of Hanover, she knows her hopes are somewhat diminished. So she does write to him and her mother-in-law, begging to be allowed to see her children again, but neither deign to reply.
No. That's so sad. She must just be hoping for that any minute Max Boneyman smashes through the wall and says, "I'm back!" and releases her. That's her only hope.
Well, and in a funny way, that is sort of not perhaps Max Boneyman, but that's sort of what George is worried about. Because obviously he's deeply humiliated by the whole thing, but it's not just personal, because he is paranoid that one of the many European powers hostile to Hanover will seek to use her against him.
In what way could they?
From 1701, he's in line to accede to the English and later British throne. So obviously he can do without Sophia Dorothea, causing a huge public embarrassment that might make Britain wonder whether this is the best dynasty to pin their hopes on for the future. But she doesn't give up her hopes of liberty. One moment where it seemed like she might be able to leave Alden was when the French invaded Brunswick, and because that's getting a bit close to where she is sent to Celle and her parents to make sure she doesn't get captured.
So she reunites with them.
So she does get to go back. Her mother's with her regularly, and they hope that this could become permanent. But her father, feeling honour-bound to stand by his agreement with George, refuses to see her, even though she's there.
Awful man.
And she is sent back to Alden. Her father's feelings do soften. In 1705, he's planning to visit her, but tragically catches a cold on a hunting trip that he was doing beforehand, and then dies, never having seen her again.
Well, he didn't really try.
Sophia Dorothea doesn't give up hope. Her mother writes to William III and later Queen Anne, hoping they'd intercede. She even writes to Louis XIV, who had obviously sent her into exile all those years ago, but he does offer them a place at Versailles, but the price would have been to convert to Catholicism, which is too high.
Oh, right.
Now, Sophia Dorothea's daughter marries the Crown Prince of Prussia, and he encourages her to write back to her mother in the hope of securing her inheritance, and he implies that he might be able to help, you know, use some influence to secure her release. With the death of Queen Anne in 1714, George becomes King George I of Great Britain, and Jacobite agents hope to use Sophia Dorothea to undermine the Hanoverian dynasty. But besides an unsuccessful effort from a few Scots to pay a visit to Alden and acclaim her as Queen of Great Britain, nothing actually comes of this. And similarly, once the Crown Prince of Prussia has established the legalities of her inheritance, he also drops his pretense at intervening to assist her release.
So at this point, the King of England has like a private prisoner. He's got his own little personal prisoner locked up somewhere.
Yeah. His wife.
His wife, yeah, of course.
Sort of ex-wife, but yeah. But there will be no escape and no liberty. Sophia Dorothea's life is increasingly empty and mundane, her only excitement being the carriage rides, where apparently she always asks for the horses to be driven at the highest possible speed.
Yeah, I bet. Live a little.
Her mother died in 1722, and when her daughter visited Hanover in 1725, but despite sort of coming past, fails to visit her at Alden, it's clear that she is nearly alone in the world.
Why didn't she visit? Because she's not allowed.
Not allowed. God. A final disappointment came when her trusted financial advisor was found to have been embezzling her money on the Amsterdam Stock Exchange.
Right. Yeah.
Her spirit seems to have been broken and she fell seriously ill, dying on the 13th of November 1726 at the age of 60, having spent the last 33 years of her life at Alden.
Well, when we come to review George I, he is feeling a dose of his own medicine.
Hmm.
And lock him up in a low score.
In response to her death, the courts of Hanover and Prussia went into mourning, which was much to the annoyance of George I, whose only concession to observing her death was a brief allusion in the London Gazette, while he himself went to the Haymarket Theatre with two mistresses to watch an Italian comedy.
What a nasty piece of work.
He had her will seized and destroyed, ensuring that all her property passed to him instead of the children, as intended.
So the children are destitute?
Well, they're not destitute, because one of them is the, you know, the wife of the King of Prussia, yes. And the other one is going to become George II, so...
Oh, right.
He wants Sophia Dorothea to be quietly and quickly buried at Alden, but a recent flooding of the river had turned the gardens into a swamp, so they literally are unable to force the coffin to sink into the ground. Just keeps popping up again.
What a lovely metaphor. He keeps trying to put her down and she's always there.
Eventually, he has her sent to Cella, where she's buried at night and without any ceremony. A few months later, George is back in Germany, as he regularly was, to visit, and according to legend, after reading a final letter from her, suffered a seizure in his carriage, and then died not long afterwards, fulfilling a prophecy that he would not survive his wife by a year.
Wow. This is all so cinematic. Oh, it just looked gorgeous as well.
Mm.
It looks like a curse.
Yeah, well, yeah. So his son, and of course her son, becomes George II, who in appearance and temperament was very much his mother's son.
Mm.
And he'd been devastated by his mother's imprisonment, and on his father's death brought out a few portraits of her that had been saved and hidden from destruction. And it was rumoured that had she survived George I, he would have had her released and brought to Britain.
Yeah. Yeah, surely.
Sadly, though, with his accession came his access to all the state archives, and he was shocked when he does actually read the letters, because he'd always assumed that it was all a big lie made up against her. So he's actually quite heartbroken when he finds that she had actually been having an affair. And thus the one man who might have restored her name instead remained very touching the subject and then never spoke of her again, even to his closest friends.
So, I mean, what massive feelings he's got to deal with, and it's just easier at that point to carry on bearing it rather than come up with a whole new narrative, isn't it?
So that was the life and, well, non-consortship of Sophia Dorothea of Cella. We'll review her after a quick break.
Life is a highway, and on it there will be many chicken sandwiches. But there's only one McCrispy, so go ahead and hit the turn signal if you know about this juicy gem of a detour.
Battleliness!
Sophia Dorothea shows a lot of fighting spirit from the off, throwing George's portrait across the room, shouting that she'd never marry him, refusing to indulge him in his mistresses, instigating furious rows, refusing to surrender to the intensive etiquette of Hanover, continuing to live according to her own style and expectations. Shows plenty of agency, most notably by embarking on an affair and going as far as planning to elope.
Yeah, she's not going to be leading anyone into battle,
mm.
But on a personality level, crikey.
Hmm. I mean, the story can perhaps be a little bit stock fairy tale. We've got the handsome knight rescuing the princess and locked in a tower. But she's not a passive player in all of this. You know, she'd gone to Cella to try and hoodwink her father into giving her an independent financial setup. She'd personally scoured her own marriage contract, trying to find a way that she could afford to pay for it all.
Yeah, I think it's cool. To me, she is like a Brothers Grimm character that's been given a modern twist by Disney. You've got Max Boneyman, she's stuck in a tower, but she's also in charge of her own destiny. It's, oh yeah, let it go, let it go. It's all that.
Even after Königsmark's murder, she refused to swallow her pride and go back to George, but insists on ending the marriage. Yeah. Throw in a little bit of attempt at dabbling with Jacobites, Louis XIV, Prussia, and you can kind of see why, like with Henry II and Eleanor of Aquitaine, that George felt like it was probably better keep her under lock and key. Against her, though, for all her agency, her spirit and whatnot, the fact remains that she was discovered And she does spend the last 33 years, which obviously in 60 is more than half of her life, in a sort of quiet and dull house arrest from which she never really seriously tries to escape.
And she nearly got free. She hadn't died. You know, if her brother was there, her
but
son
it's not terribly, not terribly battle that we said. She just didn't quite stay in quiet imprisonment long enough.
Yeah.
To be released by default.
I'm thinking about people who've been in prison a long time. Like, who's... Oh, no, Napoleon got free and then went about on his business again. Yeah.
I mean, I don't think... Napoleon? Well, he did also... They ultimately sent him to the most distant, remote island in the entire world.
And he did die there eventually.
Yeah, eventually.
Oh, I never knew that. Who's the other one? Who's the fellow that flew
Mandel.
To Germany?
Oh,
Other end of the political spectrum.
Yes.
Hess. You know, he was just kept in prison until, well, who knows what happened at the end, but because of the danger he represented.
Mm.
Is this the first time that Sophia of Brunswick, what's...
Dorotheus Teller.
Has been compared to Rudolf Hess.
Rudolf Hess, Nelson Mandela and Napoleon.
I mean, okay, so there you go. Superb battliness.
And the fact is that her downfall is very much self-inflicted. She seemed to be oblivious to the fact that everyone else knew what was going on. Everyone tried to warn her. That crucial delay, the tragic cinematic delay where she says, let's just wait one day before we go.
Yeah.
Which, of course, is quite a fatal delay, albeit completely understandable.
But all those things, and then opening the battliness coming back at the end... As a ghost in a letter to polish off George.
Yes.
So the film would focus a lot on the first half of the life and probably do a montage for the last bit.
Yes.
But you'd come out Sophia fans.
I suppose what I'm saying is in terms of battliness, I guess if we look at her downfall, she wasn't very smart about it. She sort of duped a bit, or was perhaps just a bit naive about thinking that she was going to just reject their terms, get the divorce, and just live the life she wanted to, that was ever going to be an option. That essentially, you know, she puts up a fight, but she loses badly, and you wouldn't say that she's a terrifying enemy to face.
No.
A lot of spirit, but...
Yeah, because that's true of all the Disney princesses. Mm. They're naive, really. But somehow stick to their guns. But, as you say, it is only a fairy tale ending if it is a fairy tale ending.
Yes.
But I really like her. She wants to live... She's continued to live the way she wants to live, even if it means at the cost of her liberty.
She doesn't get subsumed into the system. She keeps on being who she is in Hanover.
Which is a very 21st century... Late 20th century characteristic to be sought after.
Mm.
She was playing the Disney version in A Brother's Grim Tale.
Yes.
And the only thing they had in common was Max Bernieman.
Max Bernieman, yeah. So, a score for battliness.
I feel like I want to say 8.
Yeah, I was sort of initially thinking 7. And I was thinking, well, but I mean, it really is strong agency, isn't it? I think it feels like it gets after more than half of the life ending up being in this quite quiet, drab imprisonment. It feels like the balloon's sort of deflated somewhat by the end.
Mm.
So I don't know
real
if
life
the points
loss.
Go out with the air of the balloon.
Mm. Mm. How big was the balloon? You know?
Well, yeah. So I'm going to come down to 7.5, I think. I think I'm going to take some points off her for the way that she is sort of a little bit the author of her own downfall, and then it all just gets a bit sort of... quiet and sad for a long time.
I wonder whether I'm going to come down to 7.5 as well, because I loathe half points, but I feel like...
You could go up to 8.5.
yeah. No, I'll stick with 8. I think the amount that she was imprisoned and the extent to which people went to imprison her shows her battliness, and they were just too powerful.
Yeah, it's a very sort of narrow bit of agency. It is just on that very personal level. She's not, you know, like some of our consorts have been involved in, you know, armies and rebellions and all sorts of battle-y things, whereas this is much more personal. And I was just sort of having a little scroll up the spreadsheet and seeing what some of the other scoring people have got, and I was sort of wondering whether I might come down a another half mark, because I feel like some of the ones that have got involved in battle-y stuff and lost, we've marked down. And thus I think that given that they were taking on things like war with France or rebellion against your own husband, that therefore she takes on trying to marry somebody else and losing, she should also get marked down. So I'm going to go down half mark. I'm going to go down to 7. So 7 for me and 8 from you. There's no half marks. 15 for battliness.
Scandal.
Well, I mean, you don't have your bell anymore, but if you did, I'm pretty sure it would have been dinging.
Yeah. I'd be shaking it all over the place.
She had a reputation of being high-spirited, willful. There were rumours of indiscretions even before her relationship with Königsmark. At the age of 12, her governess was dismissed for failing to stop her exchanging love letters with a young page at the Zella court.
She is a Disney princess who's just in love with the idea of love, isn't she?
Once married, the rakish Marquis de Lassay bragged about having an affair with her in Venice, though this wasn't given any credence by anybody in her family. But the biggie, of course, is the fact that she has this affair with Philip von Königsmark. You know, some of our previous consorts are thought to have had affairs, but with Sophia, we get an attempted elopement leading to her lover being assassinated and Sophia imprisoned in a castle for over 30 years.
Yeah, and leaving a curse in a final letter.
Leaving a curse in... And as we discussed, they're remarkably indiscreet. Their intimate letters are easily discovered. They often have a very sort of teenage feel to them. So this is Sophia writing in 1692. I was so changed and depressed today that even the prince, my husband, pitied me and said I was ill and that I ought to take care of myself. He is right. I am ill. But my illness comes only from loving you and I wish never to be cured.
If that isn't the runway into a song... with a chorus of birds from around the bottom of the tower. I don't know what it is. But it is straightforward affairs. There's not anything else that we usually look for.
It does get a little bit racier. Here's Königsmark writing to her in 1693. Ye gods, what a night I spent! Why cannot I now take wings like my desire? I should at this moment be in your lovely arms, tasting the sweet delights of your lips as I did then. He also wrote of his having la petite mort in her embrace, by which he means climaxing.
And her little death.
And her calling out to him, my dear König, let's do it together.
Crikey, Graham, are you sure you've been reading the right books?
Now, it's understandable that George isn't best pleased to read these letters, but the worst of it was when Königsmark expressed jealousy at Sophia Dorothea potentially being intimate with her husband for duty's sake. And she quickly reassured him that George was a very poor lover and she was longing for him to die in battle so that she could be with Königsmark instead.
But it's absolutely stereotypical, spot on love, unrequited. I suppose it is requited, but
yes, it's very much requited.
We've had other people whose scandal is as well as that. There's been deaths and there is death.
I mean, he does get murdered,
doesn't
he?
Assassination.
Yeah.
And then she's locked away because of the size of the scandal. I feel like it's another 8.
Now, technically, it's well before George becomes King George in Britain, but it's a huge scandal across Europe. And indeed, the fact that the new king arrives in Britain with a mistress in tow while his wife is locked away in a castle and her lover having mysteriously disappeared was used to spread discontent by Jacobites who even sort of put it about that George II is illegitimate.
Yeah, I mean, that's a big old weapon to hang around.
I mean, that definitely isn't true. Time is a way off for that. But still, you can see how it remains a scandal. You know,
that
even
would
once
be,
he has become king, it's still a big issue.
That would be the concern that is shouted around the room when they're like, what shall we do? And you say, but if these people get hold of it, then they'll be saying that. there is the genuine scandal, the size of the cover-up, and the potential scandal, the potential for exploitation of this scandal. That it is actually quite big on its own.
Yeah, and I guess you can say that, some of the scandalous elements, she's not murdering Philip, she's not imprisoning herself, that's Ernest, that's George I. But I don't know, I feel like it all just forms part of the picture. Even if she's not perpetrated that, it's part of her thing.
Yeah.
The only thing against it, I suppose, is the fact Sophia Dorothea always denied committing what she called le crime, i.e. an actual full-on physical affair with him. She claimed that they didn't, though... The correspondence between them and the evidence of other people seems pretty convincing they probably did. But
I'm sticking with 8. It feels really quite punchy.
Yeah, I was wondering about more than that. I mean, you know, it's a full-on affair. As I said, we've got the lover being murdered, the imprisonment. But I know it's not her, but it's just... Yeah.
It feels it is like big.
It's all one great big...
It feels like a lot of the scandal is in the way she's treated, and it should be George I's scandal of having a private prisoner. But...
I feel like if it's a cake, she makes up a lot of the ingredients, and whilst there are other ingredients that make it a bigger, tastier cake... She is the key. If without her, if she's the chocolate and the chocolate cake,
that's the main thing.
Yeah,
yeah. This is George I's chocolate cake. Yum, yum, yum. It tastes an awful lot like Dorothea, Sophia. Yeah. So for her role in that chocolate cake, I don't know what would take me push me over to a 9. What else do you need in Scandal usually?
I'm going to go 9. You're going to be 8.
I'll go 9. I liked her.
So that's an 18 for Scandal, a very high start.
Booyah.
Subjectivity.
Well, during her imprisonment at Alden, she was celebrated quite a few good deeds, paying for the repair and redecoration of the local church, gifting it an organ. She provided significant funds to the town after it suffered a serious fire in 1715. Also gave alms to the poor, and despite her confinement in the castle, she was, in a way, quite a significant figure in the local community.
Sorry. I like the idea. I was playing with the idea that she'd given a kidney as an organ to the church and then gave out arms to other people.
Unfortunately, I've got to say, I think it's pretty hard otherwise, really, to think of anything positive to say for subjectivity. She doesn't exactly dedicate her imprisonment, the whole of her imprisonment, to good deeds. So she continues just spending most of her money buying dresses and jewellery and living like an electoral princess. And the fact that she... is prepared to cause such a huge scandal and elope with a military officer suggests her sense of duty and devotion is perhaps not a defining feature. And also, of course, you know, this is technically a series about the consorts of England and Britain, as it now is, and we'll get on to the fact that she technically isn't one at all, but, you know, she never actually even sets foot in Britain, never mind having any kind of real personal impact.
Yeah, but for this, I'm pretending that I'm a citizen of Hanover.
But for Hanover, what have you got, really?
Exactly. No, but still nothing. I can't think of anything.
I mean, absolutely, she's got other stuff going on. But for 33 years, all we've really got is that she donates generously to the church funds a couple of times.
But for 33 years, I've been locked in a tower in Alden. Alden? 0, 0, I'm afraid.
It's got to be 0 for subjectivity.
Longevity.
If... she had still been married to George I when he became King of Britain, then her consortship would have been from the 1st of August 1714 to her death on the 13th of November 1726, which would have been 12 years, 3 months. So 12.25 years, which would give her a score of 8.5, 34th best overall.
Still not good.
But, of course, she wasn't married to him. Now, the only caveat is that under English law, George I couldn't remarry while she, as his living first wife, was still living.
Right.
So, in a way, she is still a factor when it comes to who was or wasn't queen. He couldn't marry anybody else in England because he was sort of still married to her. And we did Elsgeve of Northampton, who was given a longevity score, despite the fact that although she was married to Canute, she wasn't actually his queen.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. So what would that give her?
Elfgiver.
No. Did we give Elfgiver full points for the time that she wasn't... You know,
we did score her, yeah.
I think we give the score because they were mucking around with the whole concept right at the start. Half marriage, not marriage. And he couldn't get married until she died anyway. Let's score it.
So, 8.5.
Oh yeah, still not good.
Dynasty! Not the program.
Sophia and George had 2 legitimate children, the King of Britain and the Queen of Prussia.
That's pretty good, yeah.
And indeed, her daughter was the mother of Frederick the Great, so Sophia Dorothea is also thus the grandmother of Frederick the Great.
Wow.
2 children gives her a score of 10, which is a joint 26th for the series.
Yeah.
So that gives her a total score of 51.5.
Oh, man. Tell you what, if that subjectivity score was up, she'd be all right.
She'd be doing very well, wouldn't she? So that's actually quite... That would put her in... That's 17th. That's far out of the 51 that we've reviewed, including her. But, of course, it's not all about the scores. Does she have that certain something, the lasting legacy, the great achievement, the star quality that we call...
Rex Factor!
Well, you're going to have to persuade me quite hard not to.
Well, it's a dramatic story, obviously. Dark fairy tale, romance, imprisonment, one of the most sort of obviously cinematic of the series. I think we've got a pretty obvious problem in the fact that she wasn't consort.
Oh, no.
She wasn't the queen consort. Indeed, never even goes to Britain.
Oh, how pedantic are we going to be?
I mean, I think I might be fairly pedantic. You know, the marriage is ended over a decade before George becomes king. And also, I think regardless of this, the colour and drama of the first 27 years are kind of diminished by the following 33, where she's just in close confinement to Alden, and wings are clipped. It's a very sad and protracted end to the story, but, you know, nothing much happens
after. I like surrounding myself with a bit of pedantry because I think it's important. otherwise, I'm liable to go off on one. And it keeps things ordered. So I'll accept that.
And in a way, you could say that actually the great drama and everything that comes is really the stuff that kind of goes wrong rather than... I don't know that actually she herself would have been a spectacular, starry character or consort.
Mm. I quite like the idea of her and... Oliver Cromwell having to make small talk in a green room while all the other X Factor winners are on stage and we're not quite decided on them. Yeah, I think that's... I'm happy with that. I think that's right. I dipped my finger into the well of impassioned argument and it wasn't quite so full.
You had your little Sophia moment.
Yeah.
Passion and then quietly just got subsumed into...
Yeah.
Accepting a less exciting world.
Yeah. Which ultimately polished her off. Well, that's a shame, but still, I like that she got... We couldn't give it to her on a technicality.
It's one of those where, like, we could have just not done her at all as a not consort, but I thought it's too interesting a story not to cover, and I think it is relevant to say George couldn't remarry in Britain because he was sort of, but not, married to her, so it's still kind of a valid thing. And of course, you know, she's the
whilst he was king is the thing.
Yeah, and she is the mother of George II.
Yeah.
So an excellent story, and very obviously, ultimately, a very tragic story, a fascinating story, but it's a no to the Rex Factor.
But I know I'm happy with that.
Correspondence Corner.
So that was Sophia Dorothea of Zella. Let us know what you thought about her and whether you would have given her the benefit of the doubt or not included her at all, potentially. Find us on Twitter, X and Instagram at RexFactorPod. Email RexFactorPodcast@hotmail.com and remember to send in a hashtag consort card for an episode image for Sophia Dorothea.
Oh gosh, yeah. That's got to be an easy one, isn't it? It's Disney Princess locked in a tower.
If you'd like to support the podcast, be sure to subscribe on whatever podcast provider you use. Donate monthly to join the Privy Council and get access to over 200 bonus episodes at patreon.com/RexFactor. And we have some new Privy Councillors to welcome to the fold.
Rosie Wilkinson, Elizabeth Clancy, Ruth Watkin, Shannon McMinimy, Josiah Prius, Cornelia Bernstein, Elizabeth Hutton Barber, Nina Oswald, Riza Bowers, Lindsay Bray, Claire, Kelly Williams, Raina Tyre, Tu Huang, Judy Kington Duong, Emily Corman, Rebecca Parkinson, Helen Cousins, Millie, Demian Talman, Jenna English, David K. Heidenreich, Rex and Saurus, Mandy Leigh Farr, Kate Shoesmith, and a Christmas present for Sarah Merrigan.
Merrigan Christmas.
Hey, you love a pun. That was actually a Christmas present from December 2022, so apologies that we've managed to be late for two Christmases. So that's it for us today. Next time, we will be reviewing the first Hanoverian consort proper, Caroline of Ansbach, wife and consort to George II.
But George II?
Yes.
What, George I doesn't marry again?
No. We've just discussed this, haven't we? Because he couldn't, because he was married to Sophia Dorothea.
But did she die first?
Well, yeah, because you remember, because she dies and then...
Oh, in the curse in the letter. Of course, yeah, of course. Sorry, I'll go back and have a listen. Right, cheers. Bye.